Thank you. First of all, let me thank Ingo for inviting me and all of you for attending this talk. I did not expect so many people in July here. It's also raining, so it's not so pleasant to go around. And I have also the happy surprise of finding here these friends, President von Weizsäcker, Otto, my old colleague Hans Heichel. We did a lot of business together. Business, I mean public business. We were, don't misunderstand me, we were finance ministers at the same time for our respective government. So I'm really pleased to see all of you here. Well, before going to Ireland, which, first of all, is a country that loves Europe, this has to be said, without creating misunderstandings, perhaps, on the sense of what has happened there and what is happening, let me begin by saying that I really disagree, I deeply disagree, with the mainstream of the interpretation that is usually given around Europe when something like a no in an Irish referendum occurs. At that moment, it seems that stereotypes that we have in our, let's say, sort of instinct more than mental paradigms comes out of us, and we seem sort of happy of opening a debate on the huge crisis, the deep crisis Europe is again hit from. So Europe has a crisis, and therefore let me be candidly nasty. The easiest editorial that can be written is an editorial on the reasons by which there is a crisis of Europe. Europe without a mission. Already you can write 120 lines on Europe without a mission in 5 minutes. And it's done. Then the following day, you can write another editorial on Europe without a demos. Of course, Europe without a demos. We know how to write about it. There is no demos, we have only national identities, so Europe is shrinking, and write and rewrite and rewrite. And you create the sense of something that might not be happening at all, but you seem to be happy to speak about it. It's far from the citizens. The citizens dislike Europe. How can we make Europe closer to the citizens, etc.? Everything has been written about it, but it seems that every year there has to be a show with these old stereotypes coming back. Of course, as always, in these stereotypes, there are fragments of truth. No stereotype is an incredible lie. Every stereotype has a piece of truth in itself. But the reality of Europe is that these fragments of truth are inserted into a framework that is completely different from this imaginary, failing European architecture. No mission for Europe. It's a nonsense. I could equally ask nowadays, what's the mission of France? What's the mission of Italy? What's the mission of Germany? Because it is quite obvious that every week, comparing the initial mission upon which Europe was built in the 50s with what Europe is being called to do nowadays, it's a nonsense. I cannot imagine Garibaldi running Italy for centuries. It's a nonsense. Garibaldi could just cooperate to the unity of the country once. Once it's done, it's done. And others have to pass to ordinary business, which is difficult indeed, but it's another business. Now, the original mission, because every time, this is how the argument runs, well, you know, our grandfathers, they had a mission, because we had our nation states fighting against each other, wars, one war after the other, blood flooding Europe and the entire world due to the internal conflicts of European states. And the mission, the noble mission, the great mission, was to put an end to it. And it was due to the sense of this mission, to the responsibility that the fathers of Europe felt for the blood that the world had paid for our conflicts, that led them one way or another to create an entity in which Europeans could learn how to solve their conflicts and disputes without using weapons. And happily for us, the Europeans have learned to do it. Happily for us, the mission was successful. Well, we cannot invent something of having the same quality, the same emotional impact, the same role of a trigger of something completely new. It is impossible. Viva Verdi was said in the 19th century, and it meant Vittorio Emanuele, King of Italy, etc. And if you say today, Viva Verdi, okay, that's fine. You like Verdi, and that's the end of it. So, let me give you a good news. The good news is that for sure the European Union is not a state. For sure it is much less integrated than several of us would like it to be. It is, as I frequently say and write, an institutional hermaphrodite, which is in part an international organization and in another increasing part a constitutional organization. And it shares features of both organizations. Think of the Commission. The Commission still now is the technical secretariat of an international organization and the political executive responsible to the European Parliament. It's both things. It's both things. As the Ministerial Council is at the same time the heroine of the treaties deciding and the second chamber of a parliament creating laws and regulations directly applicable to the European citizens, and I could go on. In any event, we have built a prototype, perhaps. This is why I say sometimes when I said it in the country of Queen Victoria, there was a reaction. I said the future is perhaps for hermaphrodites. I was misunderstood, and immediately I added in global governance, not in private life. In private life, I mean, it's up to you to decide, not to me to make any sort of suggestion. But I mean, we have created a sort of prototype of a multi-level system of government where there is a well-settled supranational level which is accepted by our European citizens. This is the news. Europe is not shrinking. Europe does not need to invent a new mission in order to be considered as an existing thing. The same way, even though it is not a state, our states do exist, don't have to prove that they have a reason to exist. They have good reasons to do what they are asked for and what people expect them to do. So, the notion that in Europe, in the European Union at least, we are being wound by a multi-level system of government in which each level is expected to do something, well, this is well rooted in our citizens. And if they are dissatisfied with Europe, it's not because they want a mission or something. This is for writers of editorials to do and to elaborate upon. But it is because they are expecting certain things to be done by that level of government and are not satisfied. This is the sense of it. The same way as frequently they are not satisfied with our nation, governments and states because what they expect from them is not satisfactory. But if you state the rule according to which the less people are satisfied, the less the institution involved have a reason to exist. Well, if this is your position, our nation states are much more in danger than Europe. For the simple reason that if you read the polls, you have that the rate of satisfaction with the European institution is generally 2 times the satisfaction for national institutions. And if you read these polls, what do you conclude? Let us abolish Italy and invent something else. No, you say, well, there is something that doesn't work in the relationship between national governments, national institutions, and the citizens in that country. And that's all. And let me say it immediately, not necessarily a national referendum on European matters reflects criticism against Europe. Again, here we have to speak of reality instead of remaining prisoners of rhetoric and of stereotypes. If there is something that has no sense at all, is having a referendum on Europe, nationally run, with a campaign where the citizen has his national leaders before him or her discussing about that matter. Because if my prime minister comes to my town and advocating something, it might be, let us say it might be a Treaty of Lisbon on the institutions of Europe. I look at him and I don't decide my yes or no in relation to the Lisbon Treaty. I decide my yes or no in relation to the political, let's say, open issues that exist in my country. And if their prime minister has not increased my pension as I expected, I will say no to him, whatever he's asking. I don't care about Europe. I mean, this is history now, but it is a fact that one of the main reasons by which the constitutional treaty had a majoritarian no in France was because the president of the time was not popular. Net of the rate of popularity of the president, the treaty would have had a yes. At that point, how do you react? What crisis of Europe are you speaking of? So these are the facts that have to be considered. Inventing a mission for Europe, therefore, is a nonsense. The mission is exactly what our citizens want Europe to do. And in the minds of our citizens, the items to be taken care of by the Union and the items to be taken care of by our national states are very clearly separate and distinct. Again, give a look at Eurobarometer and results of their surveys in time, not only the latest ones. You will find that pensions, taxation, welfare are matters in relation to which there is no demand to Europe. Our citizens expect our nation states to take care of these matters, plus education and others, obviously. But these are the first ones. I have listed the items in relation to which a share of citizens going from 60 to 80%, I put the floor at 60, which is much more than the majority, think that Europe should solve the problem. Between 80% and 60%, you find terrorism, environment, research, defense and foreign affairs, energy, immigration, crime. Interestingly enough, this year, inflation and price increase is becoming a crucial concern for most European citizens. Well, the share of those who think that Europe should do something about it has increased. It's still lower than the share of the items I listed before. But in a few months, it has passed from 49% to 51%, which indicates something. The more an issue seems to be important and transversal concerning all of us, the more people think this is something for the European Union to take care of. So this is the mission. Here it is. This is what people expect us to do. So our problem is, can the European Union give satisfactory answers to these demands? Can we organize ourselves in such a way as to give better answers to these demands? If I want to write an editorial, or if I want to read an editorial, I can also elaborate on these things for the satisfaction of my intellectual readers. And I can connect most of these issues to globalization, to the existing conflicts in this world, to the impact of the new economies upon us, to climate change and all of its consequences and all of the difficulties, to ideologies, extreme ideologies that are affecting some countries, generating terrorist sources. At that point, I could conclude my editorial by triumphantly writing that our initial mission was to create order inside Europe. Now our mission is to contribute to order in the world. It's very beautiful. Okay, I'm satisfied. I found the mission. But actually, the mission is taking care of these things. This is a sophisticated elaboration of the thing. But the mission remains the same, also if I don't write this beautiful closing sentence to my editorial. But I might write it, after all. Now, editorials are well paid. So if you find an easy argument for an editorial, why shouldn't you use easy conclusions? And this is part of the European crisis. And what is needed in order to give answers? First of all, leadership is needed. If I go to the missing resources, the first item that I find is clearly leadership. I want to tell you something that I learned from a friend of mine who is now mayor of Tirana, the Albanian capital, an excellent young man, Edi Rama, whom I saw days ago just to discuss the future of Albania. And we were speaking of strategies for growth in Albania and other matters. He said to me, "Listen, Julian, we were financed by the Commission. Centers of research had money in order to produce strategies for the future of Albania. We had 157 strategies. So, could you say that they don't have strategies? Well, more than 100, even more than needed. What is needed is a political leadership that transforms projects into vision that people share, into a common mission, into a widespread belief that certain things have to be done in order to go all together from here to there. Because if we want to overcome the obstacles, we have to leave where we are, we have to leave the certainties that we have lived with for years, and we have to find the courage to implement our projects. The projects are there. We know what has to be done for energy. We know what has to be done for reducing the consequences of climate change. We know what has to be done to do a better job with immigration. But the difficulty is to convince people in following a certain line, in taking certain risks. Whenever needed, you tend to remain where you are. And it's not by reading a project that you get convinced. Almighty God invented politicians as the creative resource, creating what does not exist in nature, in order to allow the others to find the courage that in themselves was not sufficient. Otherwise, we could do without them. If these things are not sufficient, it means that we need better leaders. Europe nowadays is somehow training new leaders. But, let's say, in the past, there were trained leaders who marked the big changes. So I'm not saying that I'm desperate, that we are lacking the raw material, and therefore, where are we going to buy it? In China, perhaps. Not in Venezuela. No, we have the raw materials. Some of them have still to be worked on. But certainly, a European leadership leading the others, telling some precedents. You know, I have grandchildren that are twins, but I understand that in politics one twin is already a lot. And therefore, but I mean, convincing the remaining twins, well, stop it. And putting the remaining twin in the condition to stop it. Because around him, nothing supports that position. So this is the role of leadership, huh? Creating the advantage of positions that after a while become undisputable. We have to do it. We are convinced. This is the first thing. So we have the mission, we have the projects, we have everything. The fuel that is needed is part of our problem. But of course, if we want the European leadership to grow again, we have to somehow test its capabilities more, and I will tell you something about it in a minute. Second, we also need some organizational improvements. And here we need the Lisbon Treaty. He was going back to 2003, 5 years ago. I was already linked with the treaty. After 5 years, I'm still coping with more or less the same treaty. I really do hope that nobody will invite me in 5 years to speak again of this damn treaty, which has not passed as yet. Because, I mean, we cannot spend our lives talking of treaties. But sometimes changing the rules is simply useful. Is simply useful because they add ingredients that are needed to, let's say, allow not only leaders but ourselves to do better what we are committed to. Let me give you some very simple examples of the reasons by which speaking of the treaty is not speaking of something else. Because you see, our British friends like cheating themselves and trying to cheat the others, but they only cheat themselves, by saying, well, let us stop with this damn matter of the treaty. Let's bury it. What is really important is delivery. Now, this dilemma is a complete nonsense, and they perfectly know. They perfectly know. Because you can, let's say, criticize our British friends as much as you can, but you can't think that they are stupid. They are not stupid at all. So they are cheating when they say delivery versus reforms of the institutions. The fact of the matter is that delivery can be heavily affected by the procedural rules according to which you decide. And of course, by changing the rules, you don't change your leaders. You don't change the political will you can avail yourself of. But you can avoid obstacles to prevail. You can give the timing of your decision the necessary appropriateness in relation to the need you are taking care of, etc., etc. This is very clear. A country where pragmatism is the rule well knows this kind of and understands this kind of connection. So, think of, let's say, energy, which is an enormous problem today, and where we perfectly know that none of our countries can solve the problems we have on an individual basis. Now, in the Lisbon Treaty, you find a legal basis, as we say in technical jargon, giving the community, the union for the future, the power to ensure security of supply, to promote interconnection of networks, and to, of course, supervise on the market generally. This is something without which, at the common level, we couldn't do anything. Just soft decisions that each of our member states should implement on its own, which is a much less effective kind of decision-making process. Terrorism, civil protection. How many of you know that in the treaty you find two solidarity clauses according to which, should one of our member states be the victim of a terrorist attack or of a natural catastrophe, by simply calling by phone Brussels, they would have the aid of all the other countries organized by the Union and not on an individual basis. How many of you know that not only in case of financial difficulties, as it is according to Maastricht, but also in case of difficulties of supply of energy, there is a second solidarity clause. And we are committed to helping each other in energy supply, which is an extremely important matter, due to the fact that our starting points are substantially different from each other. Of course, there are other improvements that have to do not with specific matters, but with the decision-making process as such. In several areas, we have not a sort of lack of policies. We have too many not coordinated policies, for the simple reason that due to the origin of the community, according to the patterns of international organizations, we have sectoral councils of ministers. And therefore, decisions are taken by ministers of industry in their council, by ministers for environment in their council, by ministers for agriculture in their council. And these decisions frequently are not consistent with each other. It could not happen in our national system, where Minister for Agriculture and Minister for Industry interact with each other in the same council before the decision is taken. I can give you an example that refers to something I'm still taking care of with President von Weizsäcker. The future of Kosovo. Well, in order to somehow promote a future to Kosovo, economists tell us stability as much as possible in order to have economic growth. Ministers of foreign affairs are perfectly aware that this stability requires Kosovo peasants to migrate as much as possible for some years to Western Europe to find temporary jobs and earn some money. This is part of the stability of most of the families in Kosovo. You know, it's a very simple matter. Generally, they get fiancé before their, let's say, well, in their early age. They have no money to form their families. They come to Italy, to Austria, to Germany for some seasons. They earn some money. They buy the furniture. They go back. They get married. Simple like that. Without it, they don't know how to survive at the moment. It is an essential ingredient of the Kosovar economy. I'm well aware that in the Council of Ministers of Interior, I was a member of until a few weeks ago, we tended to be restrictive for other reasons. These two policies go parallel to each other. And these are two policies of the European Union. Now, to make it short, according to the Lisbon Treaty, first, the Council for General Affairs has the new task to coordinate the policies that are being decided by the sectoral formations of the Council in order to make them consistent with each other, in order to create policies consistency. And the job of the President of the European Council is to care about consistency and cohesion. There are so many misunderstandings about the President of the European Council. He's not going to be the President of Europe. It's not expected to be an outward-looking figure that goes around in the name of Europe, sort of foreign affairs representatives, president of the Commission and everything. No, his or her job is to keep order in the House of the Council, is to create consensus among the members of the European Council. And this is another essential tool to improve the quality of our decisions, not to speak of the High Representative Vice President of the Commission, that is something that everybody is aware of, in order not to have two centers of external policies one way or another, and in order to have a single diplomatic service serving both the Commission and the Council. It's not perfect. It's typical of hermaphrodite. The male who remains pregnant. Okay, I know it is a hermaphrodite, and therefore we have to adapt. But on this assumption, we can improve things. And we can improve the relationship with the citizens. Third important item of the treaty: new legal basis for badly needed policies, new devices for improving delivery of our policies, new relationship with, let's say, the periphery of Europe, role of national parliaments, initiative of the European citizens. This makes Europe closer to the citizens. These things are still missing. People complain because these things are missing. And it may also happen that they vote against the treaty that gives them some of these things, due to the fact that during the campaign they have not discussed these things, but others.
due to the reason that if they are complaining with their prime minister, they vote against him. It is a real paradox, because if you look at the campaign in Ireland, you discover that perhaps the only argument really related to the treaty is the fact that in Ireland several electors seem to prefer a commission with a member per member state. As you know, for the future, we expect to reduce the membership of the Commission vis-à-vis the number of our member states. But should this complaint with the treaty be one of the reasons for the Irish no, this would be a paradox in the paradox. Because for those of you who are not familiar with these technical matters, give me a second. According to the Lisbon Treaty, the members of the Commission will be reduced in 2014 and should be in 2014, should pass in 2014 to 2/3 of the member states. If you reject the Lisbon Treaty, you remain with the Nice Treaty, which is the treaty now in force. And according to the Nice Treaty, the membership of the Commission should be immediately reduced. So in order to preserve your commissioner in 2014, you are losing him or her in 2009. It is quite obvious that there is a sort of missing information here, that something went wrong in that campaign, that the no was a yes and the yes was a no. And now we have quite a problem. Now we have quite a problem.
Let me tell you, because it's serious. If the Treaty of Lisbon is not approved in a reasonable time, in 2009 we might find ourselves in a sort of nightmare. And I tell you why. This is a legal argument, unavoidable. The Nice Treaty says that in 2009 the membership has to be reduced, but it does not set the figure. It simply says that the commissioners should be fewer than the member states. Fewer might mean several, it could be also one, I'm well aware. Now, don't make it so simple, please. In order to set the new figure, unanimity is needed. If they don't reach unanimity, necessarily the Commission remains what it is. But if the Commission remains what it is, due to the rigidity of the clause of the Nice Treaty, any decision adopted after November 2009 by a commission that has remained with equal number of members is void, because the commission is not legal anymore. And therefore, any lawyer could challenge in court any act of the commission. It is so. Don't be so optimistic. Not ratifying a treaty is food for lawyers. Take this argument more seriously than a professor could take it, because lawyers will use it. So we should find a solution. I'm convinced that a solution can be found. This matter of the Commission could be part of the solution.
none of the other member states is ready to restart the process of ratification once more. And the clearest sign of all came by the usual partner of Ireland, that is the United Kingdom. The day before the European Council's meeting of June, the United Kingdom concluded the parliamentary process of ratification. And a few days after, also the court decided. So the Brits said to their cousins, take care of yourself, but I'm not with you, which is an important sign. Despite their positions, I mean, the Brits are not twins. They are cousins. So it's a different kind of relationship. The other member states are not ready to reopen the process of ratification. The Irish are not satisfied with a political declaration only, restating their reasons, such as, which might be useful, Irish neutrality will be respected. Divorce will never enter your legal system without, will never enter. Better for saying will never enter. Not to speak of abortion. Social security is a nation states matter, these things. Huh? They want something more that might change the treaty without ratification. Well, if you carefully study this matter of the membership of the Commission, you might find a sort of in-between solution. Because here, the Treaty of Lisbon provides for modifications of the membership adopted not by amendment to be ratified, but by unanimous decision of the European Council. So here there might be room for something. As well as on protocols having only to do with Irish positions. Because also a protocol which has the same legal force of a treaty can be added without reopening the process of ratification as long as the content of the protocol only refer to the country that has not ratified as yet. There are precedents on this. And the other countries can agree with the protocol simply as if it were a simplified procedure, because it does not affect their own position. So these are technicalities, but they demonstrate that a solution can be found. And let me say that I like, let's say, making jokes and also teasing people a little bit. But I'm firmly convinced that the Irish want to find a solution because they are deeply pro-European. After the referendum, polls taken in different countries on the how do you like Europe, well, Ireland is still the first one. So they like Europe. They want to remain Europeans. They want to share the destiny of the others. So in good faith, I'm convinced that they will look for a solution. There might have been somebody that not in good faith has perhaps infected the campaign. We don't know. These are rumors. But certainly there is time for the good faith and the good European feeling of the Irish citizens to prevail in a reasonable time. Let me finish by asking myself and you, whether we think that in order to restore citizens' trust, which is, it should be clear, doing better what our citizens expect us to do, not invent romantic missions, but doing better what people want the European Union to do, let me ask myself and you whether thinking of an avant-garde of European countries might contribute to the improvement of our delivery and to raising the trust of the citizens. I start from the assumption that avant-garde means somebody leading all of the others somewhere, not somebody running so fast that after a while, looking behind, there is nobody remained. In this case, you are not an avant-garde. You are somebody doing your own business, which is a different kind of business. And therefore, I don't like the two-tiered models on the basis of which I understand that some of us have the destiny to be first class and the other ones second class if they are lucky. So, to be very candid and frank, I don't like the idea of a core, of a European core, where the puissance politique is exercised and a rest that only is espace économique. I can't say to any of my European fellow citizens, you know, I am puissance politique, be satisfied with being my economic space. You can say this to your flat, but not to other human beings. But the notion of avant-garde is, if not led to that disruptive point for Europe as a whole, might be used and might be useful. Firstly, in cases like this one, the Irish referendum, and relying on the European feelings of the Irish, kindly telling them, don't think that all of Europe will stop. So think carefully of the solution, because we think that we have to continue. In this case, the avant-garde materializes only as a sort of threat. And when all of the others come along, the avant-garde disappears. But the avant-garde might also be something more structured, an enhanced cooperation, such as the Lisbon Treaty provides for in defense, where it makes a lot of sense, because not all of our countries have the same level of military resources, and not all of us can take part in a structured European cooperation on defense, or also by using external instruments, which up to now have been very successful. Most of the more successful closer integration has come from treaties that we stipulated at the periphery of the community treaty, Schengen and Prüm. Some of our countries met, decided to completely abolish borders among themselves. And international flights became domestic flights, as all of us know. After a while, it became acquis communautaire. So you see, the avant-garde. Prüm is going to be the same thing. a wonderful treaty adopted upon a German impulse, due to which there is a level of integration possible between our police forces that the US of America have reached after more than a century. You remember the movies in which the bandit passing from Nevada to California was safe. Huh? Now, after Prune, it cannot happen in Europe. Passing from Germany to Luxembourg or to Austria. Again, these were treaties bilaterally stipulated that have become acquis communautaire. And there is a third level of avant-garde, which I like. This is something for the special taste of Italians, Germans, and a few others. But why shouldn't some of us federalize the exercise of some of these common competencies, whereby federalizing, I mean, having a parliament and with our European parliamentarians and a government with our ministers at the European level that decide upon these matters by using the same patterns that we use at national level. Can you imagine, in this case, at the meetings of the overall European Union, this federalized small group would go with a single voice, after taking not common decision, but single decisions, after adopting the same budget, after deciding the same taxes, after adopting exactly the same rules on immigration, after using their police forces as a federal, as a sort of their FBI, not local police. Both things would be extremely useful. They would give the sense of working together. They would give an example to others. They would for sure give the citizens the sense of an institutional setting that is closer to them, because federalizing is something that people understand. For federal states, it's a funny problem, because having two federal levels is hard. But you know, the life of hermaphrodites is much more complicated than the life of others. And therefore, they can find solutions that create balances not imaginable in other cases. We have time to think about these things. My final conclusion is that we should ratify Lisbon first, and after the ratification of Lisbon, when we are sure that the glue is there, keeping the entire of the Union together, some of us could start thinking of something more, because a wide Europe is a wonderful thing. Don't think that it's too heavy, that it's too difficult. It's a wonderful thing. Having all of these countries belonging to the same entity, all of these citizens having one way or another one of their identities in common, is absolutely wonderful in a world where identities tend to be the reason of not accepted diversities, of conflicts, of wars, and we put all these diversities together. It's a beautiful example for the world, but if there is an avant-garde that also says, okay, it's fine, what can we do with it? it may also improve our delivery. And therefore, I avoid crises for the future and prevent writers of editorial to afflict us for the future with Europe without a mission and Europe without a demos.